Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Today we focus on the intersection between liberal religion and poetry. The anthem is a setting of William Butler Yeats' poem, Aid Wishes for the Claws of Heaven, which I'll discuss with the children, along with short poems by Langston Hughes, Henry David Thoreau, time permitting, John Ciardi. So kids, if there are any of you here, pay attention, there will be a test. The morning's main event will be Ron Knapp's sermon on the poetry of Stephen Crane. Beautiful music composed by Johannes Brahms and Alexander Scriabin provide the bookends for Ron's talk. Welcoming congregations like ours do not discriminate with respect to the sexual orientation, political affiliation, gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, age, or pretty much any other defining characteristics of our members and our guests. However, discrimination in the name of liberal religion, good poetry and music is permissible, even highly prized. There are in your order of service some announcements. More of them about what we're doing are available in the Narthex in the monthly newsletter or at our website, uufm.net. But nobody has given me anything else. All right, we'll proceed. Since February is Black History Month, it is fitting to light the chalice while listening to Dreams, the words of the great African-American poet Langston Hughes, who spent much of his childhood downstream from us in Lawrence, Kansas. Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow. Looks prettier than I think he had in mind. The opening reading, selected by Ron Knapp, comes from the writings of John Milton. This is 350 years old or so, and some of the language is not quite the way we would speak today, but I think there's enough that's familiar that you'll get the point. If you don't get it, Ron may help you later. Our faith and knowledge thrive by exercise, as well as our limbs and complexion. If the waters of truth flow not in a perpetual progression, they sicken into a muddy pool of conformity and tradition. We boast our light, but if we look not wisely on the sun itself, it smites us into darkness. The light which we have gained has given us not to be ever staring on, but by it to discover onward things more remote from our knowledge. Where there is much desire to learn, there of necessity will be much arguing, much writing, many opinions. A little generous prudence, a little forbearance of one another, and some grain of charity might win all these diligences to join and unite in one general and brotherly and sisterly search after truth. Give me liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties. And though the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field, we do injuriously to misdoubt her strength. For who knows not that truth is strong next to the Almighty? She needs no policies, no stratagems, to make her victoriously. Let her and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter. The opening hymn is number 67. We sing now together as we stand now together.
We sing out together.
This is the time in our order of service when we pause to give those who might wish to share some of the highlights or lowlights in their lives in recent times. And somebody has a microphone. It will circulate among in the audience. And Gene.
One of my joys is looking forward to hearing Harry Belafonte tomorrow at McCain Auditorium at 4 p.m. I was going to check out the ticket situation because it says tickets are available for McCain, but they're free, so maybe it's for seating or expectations.
Mark Mayfield, I have a concern that there's a very large patch of ice outside the door to the Inez Alsop Sanctuary, to the upper parking lot. So I put some indicators as to where people should not walk. You should be able to see that just fine. But don't venture in behind those blocks because it's very slick, and I have no means to get rid of that ice right now. Thanks.
Others?
I have a lost tooth today.
Oh, all right.
I have a concern. My stepdaughter, Ona Hunter, who was originally from Manhattan, is dying from cancer and should be passing in the next day or two. But if you could all think of her. Her mom was Priscilla Tucker, if anybody knew her. All right.
Well, others may have thoughts that they choose not to share, but we care about them and we rejoice with you or we join you in sorrow. Well, if there are children, they should come forward here. Oh no, thank you. Oh, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Now is the time for the anthem. The choir should come forward. Thank you. Not yet. I'll try to remember to do that. Now it's the kids' time. All right, kids. Have a chair. Well, the topic this morning for discussion is dreams. And I know everybody has had dreams. I will tell you about the dream I had last night. Last night, I dreamed I had come to the church this morning, and there were people here for the choir rehearsal. I didn't recognize a single one of them, not one of them. And when I looked a little later, they had arranged themselves so that all of the men were down there and all of the women were here. And down the middle, they had laid out their parkas and snow boots and the rest. And I said, "Why have you done that?" And they said, "Kathleen told us to." Well, I said, "Well, let's get started. You know, a lot of time had been lost." And so I gave the upbeat. And the only thing that happened was a violin started playing badly. I mean, really bad. It was none of our violinists. I know that. And so it just went on. And as I was ending the dream, I was saying, "Well, clearly, we will not be able to do the anthem this morning." So I'm guessing that all of you have had dreams where you have had, you know, were glad when it was over and you had had some bad experience. But that's not the kind of dreams we're talking about today. Are you going to tell me about one? Okay, just a second.
Well, it all started when there was a prince and a kingdom. He went into a time portal and now he's in the future. Like, future. And now there's, like, cool little skateboards, like hover skateboards. And they have to go on to a mission. And I didn't get through all the dream, but I'm writing a story about it so I can figure out more about it.
Well, that's a great dream. Well, I want to talk about the dreams that don't keep you up at night or make you feel bad, but the dreams that you have. And I remembered the first dream that I had, and it happened when I was 7. My brother was 9 years older than I. So how old was my brother? I was 7. He's 9 years older. 16. So he was 16. And 16, he got a driver's license and went out and bought a car. It wasn't a very good car. But what I noticed was that my brother could go any place he wanted to, any time he cared to do it. And so my dream was to have a car. And I also noticed, however, that my brother had, often when he left, he went someplace to earn money to buy gasoline and tires and keep his car going. So I started thinking about a dream job. And so I had a dream job when I was 7. Anybody care to guess what a 7-year-old boy might have thought of as a dream job? Well, no. It was a dream that to make a living. I was looking for some dream that would allow me to pay for my car when I got it or later in life.
Selling cars?
Selling cars? No, that was not my dream. Not ever. Well, no. My dream was job was to be a veterinarian, and then I had a dog a couple years later who got really sick, and I could tell that I was not the right person to be around sick dogs. I just was not good at it, and that extended to people. I probably wasn't so doctoring was out. What happened? I had a teacher that was not a perfect teacher, but this is third grade. But she taught about all sorts of things that I found fascinating and interesting, and I thought, you know, being a teacher could be a lot of fun. And while I drifted away from that occasionally, it's a dream that did come true. And I spent 40 years plus, the time I was a grad student and also teaching people who And often I had a really good feeling about it, especially before the first exam. Then reality sunk in, and I had a sense of what was left for me. But dreams of, you know, this kind and other kinds are important. I read Langston Hughes' poem about dreams. You know, he said, hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. And the song we sang was about a man who, it's just ahead of Valentine's Day, isn't it? He was in love with some woman, and he wanted to do great things for her. He wanted to give her cloths that had reflected the nice things you see on a summer sky, or a sky, or maybe at daybreak, or at sundown, or something like that. But he couldn't do that because he was poor, and so he said, being poor, I have only my dreams. I've spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly. Tread means walk, step. Step softly, because you tread on my dreams. Yes, sir.
He was just waving.
Oh, just waving? Oh, okay. All right. we got room for you. Anyway, I looked for other poems besides these. One of them was from Two Dark Eyes Dreaming. By Elizabeth Kentley Snyder, who's written lots of books for children and adolescents. Dreams will not fly except in open sky. A fenced-in dream will die. Same sentiment, right? And finally, from Henry David Thoreau, who was born almost 200 years ago, and he says, among other things in a little poem, live the life you've dreamed. The world is but a canvas. A canvas, you know, like where you, a framed canvas where you could paint a picture or something. Our world is but a canvas to our imaginations. Our truest life is when we are in dreams awake. So, dream big. All right?
Gotta look at the word. Go in love of our hearts, go with you.
On the second Sunday of each month, all cash and checks deposited in the baskets made out to UUFM, unless you specify otherwise, go to support a cause near and dear to the hearts of our members and friends. This month's beneficiary is the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. Susan Adamczyk will remind all of us of the work done by the fund.
Good morning, everyone. First, I want to thank you for your continued support of the Second Chance Fund. The UUs of Manhattan are among our most consistent donors, and we truly, truly value the fact that you have continued to see this as a worthy charity for your donations. We appreciate it very much. This has been a busy year for us. We've had new leadership. We've rebranded with a new logo and a new website. But our mission remains the same, our mission to provide financial support to women in need of an abortion in Kansas. In 2012, we supported 249 women. In 2013, we supported 350, 100 more, virtually one woman every single day of the year. As you can imagine, that put somewhat of a dent in our coffers, so your donation this year is all the more appreciated. We now have four facilities in Kansas that are providing abortion services, but we send women to 12 other clinics in seven different states around the United States. In the period between 2011 and 2013, more legal restrictions were introduced to obstruct our access to abortion than had been enacted in the previous decade. there were 205 laws passed making 27 states extremely hostile to abortion. There are 89% of the counties in this country do not have abortion services. The restrictions include restrictions on providers, limits on insurance coverage, bans after the on abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and limits on use of medical abortion. By 2013, 22 states had five or more restrictions in place. 56% of American women live in communities, live in states that are considered hostile and that have these types of restrictions. The abortion rate in the United States does continue to decline. Last year, in 2011, for which we have the most recent data, just over 1 million abortions were done. This is a downward trend which we've been seeing over the last 20 years. However, obviously, with 1.1 abortions being performed, there is still a tremendous need for this service. So I would just like to say thank you. Thank you, thank you on behalf of all the women that we're able to help. The reasons they give are the same that we've talked about when I've visited with you in the past. Economics, child malformations, young girls who are physically too premature, too young to take on the full responsibility for having a child. It's the same across the country, and it's in our communities here in Kansas. So once again, we thank you. I want to just, sorry, one last thing. Next week, next Sunday, we will be screening the film After Tiller. It's a documentary that was made after the shooting of George Tiller. It'll be screened at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. There will be a reception preceding the film. At 3:30, the film itself starts at 5, and one of the filmmakers will be on hand for a Q&A session afterwards. If you'd like to attend the cocktail beforehand or the reception beforehand, tickets are $50. They're $20 at the door for admission. You can find out more about that either at the Peggy Bowman site, now called secondchancefund.net, or at the Liberty Hall website. And I also have some small flyers that I'll put out on the table in front. So hope to see some of you there as well. So thank you again.
Our speaker, Ron Knapp, has been coming to this congregation for many years. In addition to sermons on a wide variety of topics, he has led workshops featuring inspiring essays and poetry and shared his vision of our denomination's future. About 15 years ago, he led the first UUFM workshop on how to carry out an every member annual canvas. He's a man of many strengths. A few of you remember the dinner up the road at Doug Walters' Kansas Building Science Institute to kick off the capital fund drive to build this sanctuary, the narthex, and the new kitchen. Ron's talk inspired us to open our hearts and our checkbooks to turn our dreams into this reality. I neglected to say earlier that he's a prodigious writer and so on, and he will have copies of three of his books in the narthex afterwards. It is a real pleasure to welcome Ron back to our pulpit.
When I was a boy, Michael, I read every book. I went to a one-room country school. I read every book that we could get from the rotating library that went to the country schools on astronomy. And my dream was to run away from home and become an apprentice astronomer at Yerkes Observatory in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. I never got there till I was an adult, but Stephen Crane was a very remarkable guy with a very intriguing life story. He was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1871, the 14th child of a Methodist Protestant minister. The Methodist Protestant Church broke away from the main body of Methodism, which was then called the Methodist Episcopal Church, in 1830. The Methodist Protestants were anti-Episcopal. That is, they were opposed to the idea of bishops and wanted greater congregational autonomy, much like the Unitarians at the time. Early on, however, the young Stephen Crane rejected the religious faith of his parents. I expect he became what we would now call an agnostic. Writing, however, was important to the entire Crane family, both Stephen Crane's father and his mother. His mother was especially interested in the social justice issues of the time, wrote articles for magazines. Two of Crane's older brothers were journalists. Stephen himself began writing when he was 4 years old, and by the time he was 16, had published his own articles in various magazines. In 1891, after a couple of years of college, including some military schooling, Crane decided that, quote, humanity was a more interesting study, end of quote, than his college curriculum, and he dropped out of school to become a reporter. At times, he worked for one of his two brothers, who were reporters. At other times, he worked for the New York Tribune. And as time went on, he became a foreign correspondent and covered the Spanish-American War and the Greco-Turkish War. Once, while on the way to Cuba before the Spanish-American War, he was in shipwreck. He spent 30 hours, along with three or four others, adrift in the ocean in a small open dinghy until they finally reached shore. In Florida, while awaiting passage to Cuba, he met Cora Taylor, a madame in a brothel, who became his lifelong companion. And all the while, Stephen Crane was writing. He wrote a couple of novels, a number of short stories, an account of his ordeal on the ocean called The Open Boat. He was only 24 years old when he published what is considered to be one of the most important novels in American literary history, The Red Badge of Courage. Stephen Crane also wrote poetry, and his poems are, as you will find out, like the nature of his life, intriguing. When he was asked what he preferred, his poetry or his great novel, he replied that his poems, he liked them better than his book. The reason, he said, is that, quote, the poems are the more serious effort. In the poem, I aim to give my ideas of life as a whole, so far as I know it. And then went on, The Red Badge of Courage is a mere episode, an amplification. Stephen Crane's poems represent his worldview, his understanding of the human place in the cosmos, a place regularly being redefined by the rapid growth of scientific understanding. The literary scholar Joseph Katz writes that Crane's vision is, quote, a vision of the world in which the gods have departed and man is left alone to fend for himself. Remember that line. A vision of the world in which the gods have departed and man is left alone to fend for himself, because that will define much of Crane's poetry. When Stephen Crane set out to publish his poems, however, he ran into opposition. Just as was the case with Walt Whitman a few years earlier, the censors wanted to leave out some of his poems. The difference being that Whitman's poems were suspect because of their sexuality. Crane's poems were suspect because of his treatment of God. And at first, Stephen Crane protested. He said, in the first place, I should absolutely refuse to have my poems printed without many of those which you just as absolutely mark no. He wrote to the publishers in anger and then went on, it seems to me that you have cut all the ethical sense out of my work. all of the anarchy, perhaps. So remember that word, too, anarchy. It is the anarchy, he went on, which I particularly insist upon. From the poems which you keep, you could produce what might be termed a nice little verse by Stephen Crane. But for me, there would be no satisfaction. The ones which refer to God, I believe you condemn altogether. His publishers persisted, however, and Crane finally relented. Some of his poems were excluded, and seemingly some of those have been lost forever. For the first couple of decades after his death, the works of Stephen Crane were not generally held in high regard, even the Red Badge of Courage. But as time went on, he was recognized as being one of the most significant writers of his generation. I began this sermon by asserting that Stephen Crane was a remarkable man who had a very intriguing life story. All the more remarkable and all the more intriguing, it seems to me, when one realizes that he died in 1900. He was only 28 years old. From time to time, in my eclectic appreciation of poetry, I have come across one or another of the wonderful little poems of Stephen Crane. Whenever I came across one of those little poems, I was struck by the fact that one could end up packing so much wisdom in so few words. I'm long-winded, but he is not. Could understand such a deep understanding of the human place in the cosmos in so few words. Each poem I discovered, furthermore, seemed to speak directly to me, seemed to mirror my own quest for how I fit into the universe, and as a religious thinker, how all human beings fit into the universe. Every time I came across one of these little poems, furthermore, I would say to myself, I ought to preach a sermon on them someday. And years passed, and I never got around to doing it until a couple months ago when I gave this sermon at First Church in Omaha. And today I'm going to share some thoughts on three of the little poems of Stephen Crane with the title, Doubtless, There Are Other Roads. I'm not sure, however, that Stephen Crane would appreciate or approve what I am doing. Preaching is fatal to art and literature, Crane wrote to a friend, and then went on, I try to give the readers a slice out of life, and if there is any moral or lesson in it, I do not try to point it out. I let the reader find it for himself. The result is more satisfactory to both the reader and to myself. Well, sorry, Stephen. I'm still going to give my sermon. As a preacher, the little poems of Stephen Crane seem to me to be, at least many of them, and much of the time, compact little sermons. And I want to comment on them. But I've also chosen 10 of his little poems to be read without comment.
A little later in the service, respecting his wishes. And
so I have published a little booklet containing the 10 poems and my 3 poems. And hopefully any one of you want one, and I got a lot of them, will take it home and muse over these very intriguing, sometimes very mysterious little poems. I believe the first of the little poems I came across contained only 2 sentences, 5 lines, 25 words. Here they are. A man said to the universe, Sir, I exist. However, replied the universe, that fact has not created in me a sense of obligation. What a powerful insight packed into 25 words. As the 19th century moved into the 20th, it had become clearer and clearer as a result of scientific inquiry into the nature of the universe, that the universe, in spite of what various religions had been saying for centuries, is indifferent to human beings and human values. In 1903, just 3 years after the death of Stephen Crane, one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century, Bertrand Russell, published his Free Man's Worship, a long essay that says about the same thing that Stephen Crane says in 25 words. Here's part of Free Man's Worship. "Such an outline, but even more purposeless, more void of meaning, is a world which presents itself for our belief. Amid such a world, if anywhere, our ideals must henceforth find a home. That man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origins, his growth, his hopes, his fears, his loves, his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity..." Heroism. Is that right, Anne? Did I say it right? She says I say heroism wrong all the time. His hopes, his fears, his love are that nothing can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. And he concludes that all these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. I don't know how Stephen Crane came to that conclusion that found in his little poem, but perhaps it had something to do with those days he was a castaway on the open boat. In his essay, The Open Boat, he wrote, "When it occurs to a man that nature does not regard him as important, and that she feels she would not maim the universe by disposing of him, he at first wishes to throw bricks at the temple, and he hates deeply the fact that there are no bricks and no temples." Crane is angry about his discovery that the universe and nature is indifferent to his existence. He knows very well that he could die out there in the open boat, that he could drown or die of thirst or become food for sharks. And he knows also that the universe does not care whether he or the others on that little boat live or die. But he also knows something else. If he is not saved by the universe, if he's not saved by gods, he is saved by other human beings who do care about his existence. He and others are saved by the heroic efforts of the ship's crew that worked hard to save as many as possible. This human concern, as opposed to the lack of concern in the universe, may be what Professor Katz means when he says of Crane's little poems. In the parable-like poems, life is seen to be absurd. In the lyrics, it is implied that for life to be worthwhile, despite its absurdities, it must revolve around human love. A second of the little poems that I came across early on has four sentences, eight lines, 29 words. Here it is. "I saw a man pursuing the horizon. Round and round they sped. I was disturbed at this. I accosted the man. 'It is futile,' I said. 'You can never... You lie,' he cried, and ran on." In the first line, he sees a man pursuing the horizon. In the second line, his he becomes a they. Round and round they sped. Perhaps the man in the poem represents people throughout human history who have pursued erroneous horizons. After all, for many centuries, people thought the earth was flat, that perhaps one day one could discover the end of the earth. One could actually find the horizon. But for a long time, when learned students of the universe discovered the earth was not flat, that the earth was revolving around the sun, that the earth was not the center of the universe, people of faith Church leaders often responded, "You lie," and burned some of them at the stake, demanded that Galileo recant or be killed. "You lie," they cried, and raced on, pursuing erroneous horizons. When in the middle of the 19th century, Charles Darwin demonstrated that all living things are part of a single evolving process, this too ran against the orthodox view of the universe. "You lie," much of Christianity, as well as other religions of the world, cried out, and many still do. "You lie," and went on chasing their mistaken horizons. There was a time when black people were thought to be of a different and inferior race. I can remember in my own experience in my one-room school, a textbook that showed black people and white people, there's different lines on the evolutionary. And when learned people discovered that there was only one race, red and yellow, black and white, many church leaders cried out, "You lie," and went on pursuing their bigoted horizons. There was a time when homosexuality was seen as a vice, a violation of God-given sexual behavior, a sinful choice. Gays and lesbians were persecuted and sometimes killed. And then, when learned people realized that homosexuality was not an evil choice, but something at the very core of one's personal existence, many church leaders cried out, and still do, "You lie," and sped on pursuing their homophobic horizons. A third little poem, my favorite, has 5 sentences, 11 lines, 52 words. Here is a poem. The wayfarer, perceiving the pathway to truth, was struck with astonishment. It was thickly grown with weeds. "Ha," he said, "I see that none has passed here in a long time." Later he saw that each weed was a singular knife. "Well," he mumbled at last, "doubtless there are other roads." Whenever I reread this little poem, I really do get the feeling that Stephen Crane is speaking directly to me, that I am the wayfarer. I am the one who has spent much of my life on the pathway to truth. I've been a minister now for a minister for 60 years. I passed that milestone. It has been a lifetime for me of trying to avoid delusion. It's been a lifetime, as Anne said, of constant spiritual anxieties, whatever the word is. I can't. What? Spiritual what?
Crises.
Spiritual crises. And early on in my Christian years, one by one, I faced the weeds. That is, the numerous doctrines of Christianity. And one by one, they had to be shed if I was to continue on my quest for truth. Over time, I discovered that some of those weeds were knives. They would not let me pass. They would not let me continue on a pathway to truth. The whole artifice of Christianity, it seemed, stood in my way. So I found another road. I found Unitarian Universalism. Having found that other road called Unitarian Universalism, however, does not mean that I did not discover more weeds on the pathway to truth. As time went by, I discovered that more and more a tenuous spirituality was overwhelming the robust rationality, which for me has always been central to liberal religion. I found myself in a movement so obsessed with diversity that once was a challenging religion was in the process of trying to become an easy religion. As time went by, I discovered a growing refusal to understand how problematic God concepts are in the 21st century and not only for Unitarian Universalists, but also for almost all of the mainstream Protestant denominations. As time went by, I found myself in a movement which was once the gadfly of the religious world, moving in the direction, it seemed to me, of just becoming another mainstream Protestant denomination. For me, there were more weeds. For me, there were more knives. But then, of course, Stephen Crane was not speaking directly to me. He was, however, speaking about philosophy and religion and about how, as the 20th century emerged, a major gulf was being created between science and religion, between knowledge and belief. As we're now moving through the early decades of the 21st century, that gulf is being widened, I think, in such a rate sometimes that it seems to result in a kind of intellectual schizophrenia. We can believe only with half of our minds and be scientific with only the other half. And one result of this, which really concerns me, is that studies show that America's most eminent scientists almost completely have given up on religion. The vast majority have taken another road, philosophical agnosticism or atheism. I've been a religionist almost my entire life, and I believe there's got to be another road, a road that brings science and religion in accord once again, that makes knowledge and belief part of one single whole. Earlier in this sermon, I read a passage from the powerful essay, A Free Man's Worship, by Bertrand Russell. It ended with this sentence: only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. To understand what Russell means, one must know what he meant by the word despair. He does not mean, in our usual sense of the word, a personal psychological condition of loss of hope. He's using the word as it is used by the existentialist, referring to the absence of God, or the absence of meaning in the universe, or the death of God, or, as Crane insists in his form, the indifference of the universe to human life and human values. So I would like to express briefly my current conviction, if I, as this agnostic that I am, humanist, can use the word soul, I'd like to express my current conviction about that which the soul's habitation can, in the 21st century, be safely built. I believe that to do so, we have to be honest with science and begin with the realization, as Crane does, that we exist in a meaningless, purposeless, indifferent universe. The thought that we must begin there, that the universe does not really care particularly about us and would go on its own jolly way just as well without us, does not imply that we have to end there. This vast, magnificent universe, with its millions and millions of galaxies and zillions of stars, despite its indifference, quite by chance, has produced around a small star in a remote galaxy the planet Earth. And on that planet, life emerged. And over eons of time, human beings emerged. And you and I emerged. Hallelujah! It didn't have to happen, but it did. Our poet, for me, I consider him the poet laureate of the 20th century of Unitarianism, Robert Weston, one of my predecessors at First Unitarian Church of Omaha, speaks for me. Out of the stars rising from rocks in the sea, kindled by sunlight on earth, arose life. Ponder this thing in your heart. Ponder with awe. Out of the sea to the land, out of the shallows came ferns. Out of the sea to the land, up from darkness to light, rising to walk and to fly, out of the sea trembled life. Ponder this thing in your hearts. Ponder with awe, life up from sea, eyes to behold, throats to sing, mates to love, life from the sea warmed by sun, life washed by rain, life from within giving birth, rose to love. This is the wonder of time. This is the marvel of space. Out of the stars swung the earth. Life upon earth rose to love. This is the marvel of humanity, rising to see and to know. Out of your hearts cry wonder. Wonder. Sing. That we live. Well, here are 10 more little poems of Stephen Crane. Oh, yeah, that's right. There will be in a minute 10 more.
I walked in a desert, and I cried, "Ah, God, take me from this place." A voice said, "It is no desert." I cried, "Well, but the sand, the heat, the vacant horizon." A voice said, "It is no desert."
In the desert, I saw a creature naked, bestial, who, squatting upon the ground, held his heart in his hands. and ate of it. I said, "Is it good, friend?" "It is bitter, bitter," he answered. "But I like it because it is bitter and because it's my heart."
"I think as I think," said a man. Excuse me. "Think as I think," said a man, "or you are abominably wicked. You are a toad." And after I thought of it, I said, "I will then be a toad."
A god in wrath was beating a man. He cuffed him loudly with thunderous blows that rang and rolled over the earth. All people came running. The man screamed and struggled and bit madly at the feet of the god. The people cried, "Ah, what a wicked man!" And, "Ah, what a redoubtable god!"
Two or three angels came near to the earth. They saw a fat church. Little black streams of people came and went in continually. And the angels were puzzled to know why the people went thus and why they stayed so long within.
"Tradition, thou art for suckling children. Thou art for the enlivening milk for babes. But no meat for men is there. Then, but alas, we all are babes."
"Should the wide world roll away, leaving black terror, limitless night, nor God, nor man, nor place to stand, would be to me essential if thou and thy white arms were there, and the fall to doom a long way."
I looked here, I looked there, nowhere could I see my love, and this time she was in my heart. "Truly, then, I have no complaint, for though she be fair and fairer, she is none so fair as she in my heart."
A learned man came to me once. He said, "I know the way. Come." And I was overjoyed at this. Together we hastened. Soon, too soon, we were where my eyes were useless, and I knew not the ways of my feet. I clung to the hand of my friend. But at last he cried, "I am lost."
When the prophet, a complacent fat man, arrived at the mountaintop, he cried, "Woe to my knowledge! I intended to see good white lands and bad black lands. But the scene's gray."
As Dick is moving over toward the piano to play an F and a B flat, I mean, one in sequence, just a minute, I'll tell him to when to go. You can turn to hymnals to 145, and I'll tell you a bit of a story about this. In 1960, at the meeting where the merger of Unitarians and Universalism was voted on and passed overwhelmingly, at the end of that program, the congregation rose to sing "As Tranquil Streams," and then the doors opened and hundreds of Unitarian and Universalist ministers flowed into the auditorium in Boston, and they sang it over and over and over again. I don't know whether they had an organ or a piano. We don't, and we will do our level best to do it right. Please stand as you're able and play an F and then a B flat, and maybe play it twice, Dick.
"As tranquil streams that beat and merge and flow as one to seek the sea, our kindred hearts and minds unite to build a church that shall be free. Free from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thought and lifeless street. Free from the social code that fails to serve the cause
These little booklets of the readings from Stephen Crane will be on some table out in, whatever you call that, the foyer out there. To outgrow the past, but not to extinguish it. To be progressive, but not raw. Free, but not mad. Critical, but not sterile. Expectant, but not deluded. To be scientific, but not to live on formulas that cut us off from life. To hear amidst clamor the pure, deep tones of the Spirit. To seek the wisdom that liberates and a loyalty that consecrates. To turn both prosperity and adversity into servants of character. To master circumstances by the power of principle. And to conquer death by the splendor of loving trust. This is to attain peace. This is to invest the lowliest life with magnificence.